evening. It is Tuesday, May 5th, 2020, and it is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Here are the updated numbers for today, Tuesday, May 5th, relative to COVID-19 in the United States. We have 1.21 million confirmed cases, up from 21,278 from yesterday. We have 160,000 Americans recovered, or people in America recovered, and unfortunately 69,680 people have died from COVID-19 in America. Contrary to the narrative and some of the actions being taken, infection rates show the threat of COVID-19 is not fading. Folks, cases are growing by 2 to 4% daily, and more than 1,000 people have died each day for over a month. At least 15 children in New York were hospitalized with an illness scientists worry might be linked to COVID-19. I gotta tell you, I'm really tired of talking about this, but I don't see that I have a choice. Right now, I don't think we're seeing daylight at the end of this tunnel. I think it's an oncoming train, and I don't know that we're prepared. So for insight into this, we turn to my first guest. She has a new telemedicine practice, AskDrYola.com, AskDrYola.com, and she is a public health expert with a focus on health disparities and a professor at the Milken Institute School of Public Health at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. She is Dr. Yolandra Hancock. As always, Yolandra, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
It's my pleasure. It's my pleasure. I love spending time on the air with you. It's unfortunate that we have to continue revisiting some of these topics.
So reports show while the worst hit parts of the United States have seen new infections recede and hospitalizations drop after strict social distancing measures were put in place, the country is still in the firm grip of a pandemic. For every indication of improvement in controlling the virus, new outbreaks have emerged elsewhere, providing a steady, unrelenting march of deaths and infections. Your thoughts, please. Well, first of all, to that, but also, am I being overly sensational, alarmist, or am I overreacting here?
No, you're not. You're paying attention to the numbers. You're paying attention to the severity of the symptoms that COVID-19 presents. You're paying attention to the conflicting messaging that's being pushed out. It's frustrating and infuriating to even think that people aren't still taking this seriously, as if this was a temporary problem and now we can just move on and go back to business as usual. It's a very dangerous approach, and I think something that needs to be continued. We need to continue to discuss it so that people understand that you can't just go back to business as normal. There has to be a new normal. Otherwise, a significantly greater number of people are going to be infected and die from COVID-19.
So coronavirus in the United States now looks like this. More than a month has passed since there was a day with fewer than 1,000 deaths from the virus. Almost every day, at least 25,000 new cases are identified, meaning that the total in the U.S., which has the highest number of known cases in the world with more than a million, is expanding by 2 to 4% daily. Are those the numbers that you're seeing as well?
Absolutely. As I pay attention to the data in certain areas in states like Minnesota, you're seeing actually an increase of close to 10% per day. And people will say, oh, well, it's because we're doing a better job of testing. And that's absolutely not the case. We're still struggling with getting people tested. And although we are better than we were before, that does not give the full explanation as to why we're seeing those numbers increase, particularly when we look at areas like the Midwest, right? We look at the Dakotas, we look at Nebraska, areas that are newly starting to see significant increase in their number of COVID-19 cases. It to me, it equates to a forest fire, right? You don't stop paying attention to the fire over here and then go to the fire over there. You put out all of the fires simultaneously and create measures so that fires do not return. That's not what we're doing in the case of COVID-19.
It's interesting that you use the forest fire analogy, because I was thinking in listening to the president and some other comments, which I'm going to get to in a second, it's as though you're in a restaurant, you're eating your dinner and you start smelling smoke and everybody evacuates the restaurant. And then the owner comes back and says, oh, everything's fine. It's just a little smoke. Please come back in and finish your meal.
Come back and enjoy your meal.
Because exactly. I don't want to have to refund your money.
Exactly.
So former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie said last night, quote, of course, everybody wants to save every life they can. But the question is, towards what end, ultimately? Are there ways that we can thread the middle here to allow that there are going to be deaths? And that there are going to be deaths no matter what? We've got to let some of these folks get back to work, because if we don't, we're going to destroy the American way of life in these families. And it will be years and years before we can recover. His comments are echoing similar characterizations by a lot of other Republicans, including the president. And it seems to be the point here, it's lives versus livelihood. The economic impact of the virus is just as devastating to the nation as the virus itself. And the final thing that he said, which I really just had to laugh, he said, during World War II, when London was being blitzkrieged by the Nazis, Winston Churchill had to tell the people of London, some folks are just gonna die. He said, that's leadership. And that's what we need right now. Now, that goes back to a point that I made to you, I want to say now 2 weeks ago, when I said, you know, when you put this in the context of a war, we're at war with the coronavirus.
Right.
With the war mindset comes collateral damage. There are a certain number of deaths that we are going to accept, because in war, that's what happens. As opposed to dealing with this and approaching this as a public health crisis where the focus is save every life possible.
Right. It's prevention and intervention. It's the best of both worlds in terms of medicine and public health. There has not been a time in the over 15 years that I've practiced medicine where I threw my hands up and just said, eh, some of y'all are just going to die. That's not ever a thought that's crossed my mind. It's always been about what steps do we need to take to, one, prevent disease from establishing itself, and two, for those who have it or at risk for it, what do we do to mitigate the risk of them having either complications or death? This is the problem when you have people who have no expertise in public health or in medicine and who refuse to listen to those of us who do and instead simply make their decisions based on the economy. I mean, I think James Carville said it best. It's the economy, stupid. That's what people are thinking of. They're thinking of profits over people. We can recover economically. What we cannot do, you know what is going to impact a family? As if their income earner is the one that gets COVID-19 and dies, right?
There you go.
We look at meat packing plants across the Midwest. We are seeing them as the hottest hotspot right now. Those meat packing plants are employing a good number of Black and brown people, if we're really honest with ourselves. And again, it goes back to something that we talked about before. All of a sudden, people became expendable and disposable when the majority of people with COVID-19 infection and death were reflected of Black and brown communities. If the majority of those, predominantly in these urban areas and in these hotspot states, if the majority of those who were dying, succumbing from COVID-19 were middle-income Caucasian males and females, our conversations would be different. But there was literally, physically a pivot point the minute data came out demonstrating that African-Americans and Latinx communities are disproportionately impacted by COVID-19 infections and death. And it's not a coincidence.
To that point, rural towns that 1 month ago were unscathed are suddenly hotspots. It's not just the major cities. Smaller towns and rural counties in the Midwest and South have suddenly been hit hard, underscoring the capriciousness of this pandemic. It is rampaging through nursing homes, meatpacking plants, and prisons, killing the medically vulnerable and the poor, and new outbreaks keep emerging. This is an ominous harbinger of what a full reopening of the economy can bring, but still, they keep trying to, in their minds, strike this balance. I don't understand, going back to Christy, if we don't, we're going to destroy the American way of life in these families. To your point, that family in New Jersey that lost, I think, 5 people within 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
Ask those folks, would they rather have their mother back or would, and I'm not dismissing people's paychecks. I understand.
Right.
But here's the thing. Stop launching these $34 billion aircraft carriers. Stop sending, missiles, Tomahawk cruise missiles at $1.5 million a missile into Yemen. There are a lot of things that we can do. Budgets
right.
are numeric representations of priority. And so
exactly.
If lives versus livelihood is really your dilemma, it's not that we don't have the money, it's where we choose to spend it.
Exactly. And to your point, I appreciate the honor of the flyovers and the Blue Angels, but all I could think about is people were celebrating healthcare heroes is the money that was spent. Like, reimburse me for my telemedicine visit. How about that? Give me the SBA loan that I was supposed to qualify for instead of giving it to Ruth Chris. Don't waste money on jet fuel, pilots, and flyovers if you cannot protect me with a mask when I see patients infected with COVID-19. Give me the proper PPE. That's how you celebrate me. That's how you make sure I can go back to my child without risking my life or hers, not flying over to celebrate and honor me. It's a waste of money, especially when then you say we have to open up in order for the economy to recover, which then further impacts my ability as a healthcare professional to manage the COVID-19 pandemic. It's an insult.
Please take off your public health hat and now put on your pediatrician hat. 15 children in New York City have developed a puzzling and serious inflammatory syndrome possibly linked to COVID-19. New York City health authorities are warning of an unusual and potentially serious inflammatory condition possibly linked to COVID-19 that has sent 15 children to the hospital between the ages of 2 and 15. It's similar to a syndrome known as Kawasaki disease. Talk about that, please.
Yes, so we saw 15 cases in New York. We've actually seen numerous cases across the country. And in Europe, little ones actually presented with what we call atypical Kawasaki. So Kawasaki is an inflammation of the small blood vessels within the body, inclusive of the coronary vessels that provide blood to your heart muscles. It's caused by an inflammatory response in the body, likely due to the COVID-19 infection. It presents with fever, red eyes, swollen lymph nodes, swollen lips, swollen hands and feet. And usually what will happen once they present with all of those symptoms, we will also get an ultrasound to see whether or not their coronary artery vessels have been affected by the inflammatory process. It becomes very, very scary when that happens because little ones can actually develop heart failure and cardiac arrest because clearly if you inflame the blood vessels that provide blood to the heart muscle itself, that's going to impact how well the heart functions. It's a very rare disease, but the fact that we are seeing increasing numbers of it makes it very, very scary for me as a pediatrician and as a mom.
Now, as I understand it, none of the children that were admitted to the hospitals in New York, none of those children have died. 4 of the children in New York tested positive for the novel coronavirus. So that means there were 11 that did not. All of the patients were admitted to intensive care and required cardiac or respiratory support. Now, I also read that Britain's National Health Authority, they issued a similar alert in April, and I'm not sure how to frame the question. So Britain saw it in April, and now we're seeing it here. So,
Right. And
Britain had COVID-19 problems the same way we're having. So is there a pattern here, or is it too early to tell? I guess it's the simplest way I can ask the question.
I think the most important thing is to recognize the pattern. Not only did Britain demonstrate cases, but the Netherlands did as well. There was a recent study that was released that demonstrated 50 different children developing what we consider to be atypical Kawasaki's. And when we use the word atypical, in order for a child to qualify as having the Kawasaki's diagnosis, it requires that they meet all of those diagnostic criteria, all of those symptoms that I just described. When they're missing two or three of them, we classify that as atypical. It's important for us to be on alert because a lot of practicing physicians recently haven't really, because I mentioned before, it's rare, a lot of docs have not necessarily recognized or wouldn't recognize Kawasaki's as something to be concerned about, particularly when we're thinking about it in this COVID-19 space. So it's very important for us to pay attention to this because Kawasaki's disease requires a very specific treatment. And if that treatment is not started early enough, it further impacts the possibility that the child will make a full recovery, particularly as it relates to cardiovascular health.
So now you can put your public health hat back on. Thank you very much. The president is cheering on governors, even as they ignore White House coronavirus guidelines in this race to open. States across the country are moving swiftly to reopen their economies despite failing to achieve benchmarks laid out for the White House for when social distancing restrictions could be eased to ensure the public safety during this pandemic. We've got Texas, Indiana, Colorado, Florida. They're pushing forward with relaxing their guidelines again, even as the number of people testing positive in many states has increased in recent weeks, and we still have insufficient testing. This does not make sense to me.
It makes no sense. Not only do we still have insufficient testing, we also have insufficient modalities in terms of doing contact tracing, right? So if someone comes into contact with someone who's tested positive, what modalities do they have to actually trace that contact? What capacity do we have to isolate those who could otherwise not be isolated if they're living with family members, if they're living in public housing, any of those environments that make it difficult for them to self-isolate? When you look at the president's requirements, and I put that in air quotes, I wish you guys could see me, it makes no sense. What they do completely contradict what they list out in terms of a phase one rollout for reopening states. When we think about social distancing, there's supposed to be a way in which restaurants and other establishments like gyms are supposed to implement social distancing. One, those plans have not been established. Two, who's there to enforce what is supposed to be happening? When we see folks going back to restaurants, even here in Maryland, Ocean City has now, in the middle of the night, announced late last night that they would be opening this weekend. Who within the state, within the city even, is assessing whether or not the practices, the requirements that have been pushed out federally and statewide, who is there to make sure that any of this stuff is happening? If that isn't the case, we're going back to where we were pre-COVID, except that COVID is here to stay and it further increases our numbers. And we won't really be able to see the impact until 2 weeks from now when we have another surge.
Final question for you, and this just happened yesterday. The White House is distancing itself from a draft, and I underscore draft, federal government report predicting an explosion of new coronavirus cases and 3,000 daily deaths by the 1st of June. Now, this was a CDC draft report. Some of the slides have the logo of the CDC on it. My question to you is, since the report is in draft form, should it be dismissed, if not ignored? The White House and others are saying the numbers had not been validated. It was going through. So, as a public health expert, your thoughts on this hoo-ha-ha over this report?
I always, at this point, well, throughout this pandemic, I always put an asterisk around any information coming out of the CDC. When their messages have been inconsistent since the start of this, it would not surprise me if from draft form to public data availability form, those numbers completely change.
Will the numbers change because they find the numbers are wrong, or will the numbers change because they don't want the public to see these numbers?
I wouldn't be surprised if either of those things happened. One, I need to know where these projections come from, number one. Number two, if they come from a reliable source and then the numbers change, I can guarantee you we'll not get a clear justification as to how these new estimates now change. Clearly, based on delays in testing, delays in a lot of the critical information that we needed in order to create an appropriate response, I cannot trust our federal government to push out information that we can trust in terms of the numbers of cases and the projected death. My information sources include academic institutions like Johns Hopkins. Those are my sources. And a good number of times, they do not compare to the numbers that are being pushed out by the CDC.
Okay. Dr. Yolandra Hancock, go to AskDrYola.com. Go to AskDrYola.com. As always, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your analysis. Look forward to having you back.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you. All right, folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. The immunity of tech giants. When the pandemic is over, should we fear the tech industry more than ever? According to Kara Swisher, if power tends to corrupt and absolute power corrupts absolutely, how can we best describe the kind of power big tech will wield when the coronavirus crisis is over? Well, for insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He is a web developer and technologist, Chris Garaffa. As always, Chris, welcome back to The Critical Hour.
Thank you for having me back on, Dr. Leon. It's great to be with you.
Thank you, man. Great to have you as always. So before we get into the nuts and bolts of the question, just overall, do you think this is a valid question? Do you think we should be concerned about the power of big tech going forward?
Yeah, you know, I really appreciate what Kara Swisher has written here in the New York Times opinion. I think the major thing I disagree on is that we don't have to wait for the pandemic to be over to fear the tech industry. We should be fearing it and working to address that now. We have been for many years. This is not just after this pandemic is over. We're seeing right now that big tech is taking advantage of this crisis in a number of ways. They are taking advantage of the fact that people are willing to, you know, use apps to track, you know, whether they've been close to somebody who has, you know, been infected or tested positive for COVID-19. They are taking advantage, certainly, of the fact that we're all spending more time online. Whether you're working from home or you're unable to work, people are on Facebook and Twitter and Reddit and all of these other sites, more every day, because frankly, there's not a whole lot else to do during shutdowns. And so, they're monetizing, our crisis, and they are increasing their surveillance of us.
So technically, those are some incredible points. And one of the things that I find very interesting, and I always turn to this, I guess, as a social scientist, the cultural aspects of this. I have friends who live in South Korea, and in talking to them, there are no issues with the social tracking that's going on. There are no problems with the government for those who are supposed to quarantine for 2 weeks, tracking your bank card to see where you go to get your money, how far away from your home you're going to get money, and where you're shopping, and are you adhering to the guidelines for self-quarantine? When you go into the country, before you're allowed through customs, they check your phone to be sure that you have the app on the phone that the government's going to use to check you and to track you. Culturally, they're fine. Whereas here, those are 1984. That's Big Brother looking over your shoulder and invading into the privacy of the individual.
Well, I mean, it's not just 1984. It's 2020. It's 2011. We learn every day about governments and private corporations and their absolute overreach with our information. So, you know, if your friends in South Korea are willing to trust their government, they, you know, they may have good reason to do so. Certainly, we need to have precautions in place, you know, in terms of addressing the COVID-19 crisis. However, contact tracing has been around for decades. This is, you know, this is not a new method of tracing and tracking the spread of a virus. You know, it was, you know, most famously, scientists worked on it during the HIV/AIDS crisis and were able to track the spread of HIV throughout communities. And they weren't doing that with big data. They weren't doing that with giant tech. Instead, what we're seeing now, you know, there's an excellent article on Reuters last week talking about two primary firms, the NSO Group and Cellebrite. These are, they call themselves intelligence firms, but basically they make spy devices. And they are pitching governments around the world on using their spy software and devices to help track COVID-19, basically allowing governments, police, whoever they want to sell them to break into a phone, in fact, to find out where somebody's been, or to install spyware on a phone without the person even knowing it in order to track their location. You know, they're promoting these apps primarily in India and Israel. There are other groups working on this. Palantir, most famously, is working with the NHS in the UK. Palantir is most infamous for working with ICE. At this point in the U.S. to track undocumented people and let ICE pick them up. So these tech giants, you know, we are in the U.S. and in the U.K. and in across much of the world, unfortunately, are not respecting our rights. And they're using the crisis to make money as well. You know, ultimately, that's what they want to do. They want to make money. The government wants to have more power and control and surveillance capability over us, and they're working hand in glove to make that happen.
So what do you say to the person who says, well, Mr. Garafa, I'm not doing anything illegal anyway, so I don't really care if the government, if they want to follow me around all day, let them follow me, because I'm just going to the zoo and I'm going to the grocery store and I don't really care what they do.
Well, I would say to them that we have a number of examples of people who have been caught up in police stings and been arrested because their phone put them near the location of the crime the day and the time that the crime happened. One example, it was out of Texas a few months ago. A gentleman was going for a bike ride, and that bike ride took him near the house of where a woman was assaulted. And the police got phone records, not just for him, but anyone who was in that general area that day and time, and they arrested him. And he had to actually fight to get that thrown out. He had to pay a lawyer significant amounts of money to get that thrown out. So even if you don't have anything that you think you need to hide, consider that the entire surveillance state combined with law enforcement can just suck your information up and make you look guilty without any, you know, reasonable basis.
So what are we to glean from the stock value of these tech firms? Wall Street vaulted the stock of Amazon, is now up to $2,400 a share this week from $1,838 at the end of January. Microsoft is now valued at $1.32 trillion. Apple, $1.26 trillion. Alphabet, $900 billion. Facebook, $577 billion. This group of companies makes up just over 20% of the S&P 500. So based upon the value of these companies, what does that say to you about the power of these companies?
Absolutely. So let's take the example of Amazon. Let's take the example of Amazon Shopping, first of all. So Amazon Shopping, they are for some people, the only possible option you have to get goods, especially as, you know, supermarkets are still running low on paper goods, on fresh fruits and vegetables and things like that. And smaller markets have just absolutely had to close because they just can't stay open for financial or legal reasons. So Amazon, as a shopping service, is seeing a huge increase, of course, in, you know, in people buying stuff. And at the same time, we have seen across the country the conditions that the workers are in. They have, you know, extremely low labor regulations in their warehouses, extremely poor situations for the workers there. And they do that to increase profit. Workers are having to work even harder now. And they're working close to each other, not 6 feet away, not 10 feet away. They're working very close to each other on these production lines to get these boxes out, because we need stuff to, you know, to survive. And, you know, people are ordering books and other goods and furnishing their homes and whatnot because they're stuck at home, right? So Amazon certainly is making money there. The other thing to consider about Amazon is that their web services is actually also making a significant amount of money, over $10 billion they just announced in the last quarter. Now, that is Amazon Web Services. You don't use that yourself. But the websites that you use probably use Amazon Web Services, so that you don't have to have your, if you run a website, you don't have to have a server in a closet and manage it and all of that. You just have Amazon deal with that for you. They've got giant data centers, and then you pay them for the processing time and the bandwidth that you use. So, of course, as we are now all online with video conferences and all of that, Amazon's services are seeing a great increase in usage on the website as well.
And we also have to look at, as the value of these companies increase and the power of these companies increase in the marketplace, then it then creates this greater schism or division between the haves and the have-nots in terms of how do new ideas get to the marketplace? How do startups get off the ground? How do they generate revenue? How do they generate capital if these behemoths or these leviathans are eating all the little fish in the pond?
Right. It's becoming increasingly difficult to do that, even outside of the pandemic crisis. If you want to compete with Facebook or Apple or Amazon, you effectively can't. You have to find a niche market and target there. And you're going to have to go for VC funding, venture capitalists who want giant returns on their investment after a number of years. And ultimately, you're going to end up selling your company to one of the big ones, FANG, the FANG groups, Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Netflix, Google. There is, you know, this is not a free market. This is a market controlled by these giant tech conglomerations and monopolies, effectively. You know, we're not seeing innovation that is consistent and innovation that lasts. We're seeing small companies either being completely priced out or shut out of business, or they're just being gobbled up because their investors are seeking higher and higher rates of profit off of their investments. This is not a market, and it hasn't been even before COVID, where a new idea, a new company could survive and thrive on its own.
So what we have is an oligopoly. And with the limited competition with a few companies, and just quickly, we have about 2 minutes left. There's also then a huge lobbying issue here in terms of who is actually influencing decisions that are being made in Congress.
Oh, without a doubt, not just Congress, but on the local level as well. We have, for example, Microsoft is lobbying in a number of states and writing their facial recognition privacy laws. Microsoft makes facial recognition products and offers services in that area. And they are basically going in, writing the laws for legislators in order to be able to make sure that their products comply with the laws, not to guarantee that they're, you know, it's not to go and change their products. So yeah, we're seeing, you know, this all over the place. All of these companies, whether, you know, it's a progressive looking Apple or a behemoth Facebook, all of these companies exist to make profit. They pay lobbyists tons of money on the local, state, and federal levels in order to get the tax and law changes that they want. And that is the reality of this. And we, you know, it seems like we're powerless against this, but we, you know, I always want to make sure people know we can fight. people are fighting back on the labor level, on the in organizing for privacy, and on the economic level. And we can't keep, we can't forget that even though they have all the money, we have the power here. We have the numbers, and we can actually win in these struggles.
Well said, Chris Garaffa. As always, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate your contribution to the Critical Hour. Look forward to having you back.
Great. Thanks very much.
You're listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. The New York Board of Elections canceled the Democratic presidential primary last week, citing the risk of spreading coronavirus. Now, Bernie Sanders supporters and others are angry. Is this another cynical, anti-democratic maneuver against Bernie Sanders? Well, for insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He is the co-founder of Black Alliance for Peace and former vice presidential nominee for the Green Party. And he is Ajamu Baraka. As always, Ajamu, welcome back.
Glad to be back again, Dr. Leon.
So when Sanders officially suspended his campaign on April 8th, a number of people said, oh, there he goes again, falling in line with the establishment. But he made it clear that he would stay on the ballot in upcoming primary contests to accrue delegates and wield some influence over the party platform and rules come convention time. Now, New York does away with the Democratic primary. Your thoughts on this maneuver?
Well, from the point of view of the Democrat Party and the Democrat Party in New York, it made perfect sense that why waste money on a beauty contest? The problem with the Sanders campaign, and I really feel for many of the Sanders supporters, is that when he surrendered, he basically lost all real leverage with the party. And this notion that he was going to use his delegates in order to influence the Democrat Party platform is just complete and utter nonsense. In fact, it's even kind of insulting, because who cares about the Democrat Party platform? Like, that has some kind of impact and accountability for Democrat Party candidates. It has nothing. So, this wasn't surprising, and it is just another lesson for real activists in terms of how you don't surrender power to a foe before the battle, in fact, is won.
There are lots of dedicated Bernie folks who truly believe in the process, and this to them is a slap in the face. One would think that the Democratic Party leadership would have learned a lesson from 2016 and at least given the appearance of some type of inclusion. Are they afraid of engaging? Is this arrogance? Do they think that beating Trump this time is going to be easier than beating him in 2016? How can they be so myopic?
Well, Dr. Leon, I've said on your program more than once that the Democrat Party elites were less concerned with defeating Trump in November than they were with defeating Sanders during their primary. Mm-hmm. They wanted to keep control of the Democratic Party apparatus, that is the apparatus itself. And so to do that, they had to defeat this insurgent candidacy. That's been done. So they're less concerned about the election in November. So in terms of whether or not the Sanders folks are going to vote for Trump or vote for Biden, I think they have calculated that most of those supporters will, in fact, vote for Biden, because everybody has swallowed this notion of Trump being this existential threat that requires sacrifice and requires that you surrender your critical faculties and vote for the blue candidate. And so they have decided that that is the route they're going to go.
So to that point, Ajamu, in terms of people just sucking it up, Zohar Gitlis, a volunteer for the Sanders campaign, after supporting Sanders in 2016, she door knocked for Clinton that October due to her concern over Trump being elected. This year, she believes she spent somewhere close to 10 hours a week on the campaign for a month and a half, including gathering signatures for ballot access, phone banking, and volunteering in New Hampshire. This is what she said. I did a door-to-door during a snowstorm one Saturday afternoon asking for signatures. This is one dedicated campaign volunteer. It seems as though, and there are a lot of people, this is just one example, there are a lot of people out there with this same sentiment. Now they feel insulted. Now they feel betrayed. They feel slapped in the face.
Yes, yes, and I can understand that. And it's really a shame, as I said earlier, that their candidate decided to fold up the tent right in the midst of the battle. Clearly, in my opinion, he was not serious about really representing the interests and the desires of his supporters. They were in this struggle, it appeared to me, Dr. Leon, to fight for the soul of their party, to make sure that the ideals and the policies that they said that they believed in were going to be front and center in the debate within the Democrat Party, and that Sanders was prepared to, in fact, fight all the way for those policies and for the principles he said that he was committed to. But for reasons that weren't that clear, because, you know, people were talking about the numbers and all of this, the Sanders campaign decided to fold the tent in early April and relinquish any real leverage they had with the party in order to engage in what they call a show of unity, right at the time where not only the party, but the country needed a critical voice in the midst of this pandemic, where people are losing their lives unnecessarily because of the lack of health care and the lack of a national health care system, where the ruling class is driving workers back to work in the midst of this pandemic, and there's no national critical voice to counteract any of that. So people are disappointed, not only people who support Sanders, but people in this country. This Sanders surrendered right in the middle of the most severe capitalist crisis, perhaps in the history of the capitalist system. So, yeah, they are feeling disrespected, but the disrespect is not so much with the Democratic Party. It should be disrespected from their own candidate, Bernard Sanders.
And to that point about Bernie bailing at the front end of this crisis, Biden releases plan focused on African-American community, racial disparities in COVID-19's impact. What he calls the Lift Every Voice proposal focuses on addressing racial disparities that exist within education, healthcare, the economy, environmental justice, criminal justice, and voting rights. You sent me, I think yesterday, a piece you penned entitled Coronavirus and the Crisis of African American Human Rights. Your thoughts on the Lift Every Voice proposal and, in the context of your analysis, coronavirus and the crisis of African-American human rights?
The crisis that the human rights crisis that face the African-American working class and poor cannot and will not be addressed by Biden's pandering campaign that appeals to the sentiments of black business people. You know, he's suggesting that one of the main concerns that we have in our community is gun violence. You know, it's really off. And basically, in the context of the crisis we are facing, where African American workers are forced to go to work, they have no sick pay, they have no personal protective equipment, they are being required to work in unsafe conditions and then come back to their communities where they cannot engage in social distancing because we live in houses and apartments where there's three generations of our family. You know, this plan does not speak to the realities of African Americans and poor folks. There is an ongoing human rights crisis because the state is unable and unwilling to address the objective human rights needs of our people. Our people need to have clean environments. Our people need to have access to health care. Our people need to know that they can send their kids to affordable and adequate child care facilities. You know, we have objective human rights needs that this state and this system is unable to address. So this crisis that we are facing continues, and it cannot and will not be addressed by the mild and ordinary policies being advocated by the Biden campaign.
He talks about on the economic front, his plan calls for more funding for the SBA's Paycheck Protection Program. He talks about a renewed focus on ensuring that funding is received by African-American-owned businesses that have been hard hit by this pandemic. He highlights previously announced support for progressive policy, what they call progressive policy proposals on student debt and loans. And he also calls for criminal justice reform, which I find amusing since of his involvement in criminal justice reform, which has caused so much of the problems that we have now. Your thoughts on those points?
The idea that Joe Biden would be concerned with the criminal justice reform is laughable. But it's the kind of pandering that we're seeing that's been part of the electoral season this year. And it can't really be taken seriously. If Biden was concerned about student debt, let's talk about student debt forgiveness. He has a program where he is going to forgive student debt, he says, for incomes up to $125,000. That's a good step. But one of the things we have to also be aware of, that all of these policies he says he's going to champion are policies that have to be accompanied by legislation. And we have not seen any evidence, even during the Obama administration, of real commitment to passing legislation to address some of these needs, these human rights needs that we have as working class people in this country. So, you know, whether it's student debt or it's fully funding child care, and pre-K education, all of these require a real commitment on the part of the legislature in the U.S. We have not seen that kind of leadership or commitment coming from either one of the parties. So we are not too impressed by these proposals coming from the Biden campaign. Not at all.
Axios has a piece entitled "Coronavirus Crisis Expected to Drag Neighborhoods Deeper into Poverty." The number of high poverty neighborhoods in the U.S. has increased at an alarming rate over the last 38 years. This is according to a new report out today from the Economic Innovation Group. The analysis found that more and more neighborhoods that fall into poverty end up staying there. What a revelation. Stagnant wage growth in these places has made it very difficult for them to improve their fortunes, even in good times, and that was before the severe economic crisis brought on by coronavirus. You sent me a piece from Black Alliance for Peace entitled "COVID-19 and Class Collaboration," wherein you write, "The COVID-19 pandemic has not only stripped away the veneer of respectability and promise that neoliberal capitalist development was supposedly going to offer workers in countries, it has revealed in stark terms the repressive reality and potential for a dying capitalist order." Talk about your piece in the context of this Axios piece and the study from the Economic Innovation Group.
We have been saying consistently that the focus has to be on the structure of this economy, and that the policy of Donald Trump or the aspirational policies even coming from a Joe Biden, that basically the structure of contemporary capitalism is such that there's no recovery from this global economic collapse. These communities that have fallen deeper into poverty are, in fact, are going to stay there without an aggressive and radical intervention by the state, that the ongoing human rights crisis that face communities and individuals will continue, that the so-called return to normalcy is something that even if we was able to achieve that, it would be a continuation for our community of situations that were dire in the first place. We never recovered from the collapse of the economy in 2008-2009. So these are structural realities that basically there's not going to be any recovery in terms of the employment levels coming out of this Corona-19. And what people are starting to understand is just that, that there are these structural contradictions that have resulted in them understanding that as workers and poor people, they have no rights and no one cares about them. They're being driven back to work in order to save the economy. And that understanding of the fact that they have interests very much different from the interests of the bosses is resulting in a new kind of radicalization that we have not seen in this country since the 1930s. So, you know, the emphasis has to be on looking at the structures, the material realities, as opposed to any of these sort of liberal, diversionary kinds of policies and programs being advanced not only by the Democrats, but also the classical liberal, neoliberal policies being advanced by Donald Trump and his supporters.
Former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie said last night, quote, "Of course, everybody wants to save every life they can. But the question is, towards what end? Ultimately, are there ways that we can thread the middle here to allow that there are going to be deaths and there are going to be deaths no matter what? We've got to let some of these folks get back to work, because if we don't, we're going to destroy the American way of life in these families." Help me understand that. And that's a mindset that is being articulated by a lot of Republicans. We just have to accept people are going to die and we got to get this economy moving again.
You know, Dr. Leon, that is a position that has been pushed out there for the last few weeks, not just by the traditional kind of Republicans, but throughout the business community. There, you know, we saw op-eds coming from the New York Times. We saw comments coming from the Washington Post. Of course, articles in the Wall Street Journal that said that the U.S. had to get back to work, that the U.S. economy was being threatened in fundamental ways. So this is the perspective of the bosses, of the rulers. And so they are making a cynical, calculated assessment that there are going to be numbers of human beings who, in fact, will die. But that should be offset by the reconstitution of the economy. And that is the kinds of calculations you have when you're living in a society that is ruled by capitalist principles. The value of human life is secondary. What's more important is the system, the machinery, the profit-making machinery as a whole. So this is the kind of mindset that we are dealing with, and that's why they are saying now up to 130,000 people may die as a consequence of them, quote unquote, reopening the economy. But they have calculated that that increase in numbers will be worth it if they're able to go back to, quote unquote, normality.
If we don't get these people back to work, we're going to destroy the American way of life in these families, and it will be years and years before we can recover. As though losing the breadwinner. What happens in the family? Now, I'm not talking about morally. I'm not talking about in terms of the family dynamic. What happens in the family if the breadwinner dies? Or in many of these households, you have two parents working four and five jobs just to be poor. If you lose one of those parents who's working the second job or the third job out of five, what happens to, they're not going to recover. It is unfathomable to me that not only that he could think it, but that he could articulate it and not even bat an eye in saying it.
Exactly. Articulate it and get away with it, because that is the internalized logic of capitalism that most people have in this country. What we're seeing, Dr. Leon, is the real shortcomings of of market capitalism. We had a different kind of organization of the economy. We have a different kind of conversation around the values of human life. We don't have that, and therefore human life is expendable. It's all about the Benjamins, as Representative Omar said.
Jamu Baraka, as always, thank you for your time. Thank you for your analysis. Look forward to having you back.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. All right, folks, you've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.